or gamma rays, or I guess more generally, photons. So photons are a bit nice relative to particle cosmic rays in that they more or less just go in a straight line. So you can take your telescope, point it at a source, and if you see high energy photons coming from there, you can be pretty sure that that's where they originated. So with photons, you have a pointing ability. The other thing with photons is that you can look at lots of different frequency bands. So you have a sensitivity to anything from radio frequency all the way up to multi-TeV. And you can get different information from these different frequency bands. So just like we looked at fluxes of looked at fluxes of cosmic rays, you can look at photon cosmic fluxes. And the way we usually write this is you look at the flux dependent on the energy and also on a certain direction. So n hat is the direction that you're looking at. So if this is my so here's a person looking. And I start with some, I look at some source, and the n hat direction is just the direction to the source. So as far as this goes, how shall I write this? There's going to be a piece that goes like the annihilation cross-section of dark matter. So this times the frequency spectrum. So this is the total cross-section. And this part tells you the energy spectrum of the stuff coming out of the annihilations in terms of photons. And I want to divide that by the dark matter mass squared. And then I'll write this this way. Okay, so what I mean by these different pieces is that this piece is an integral over all the places the photons could have come from. So if I'm looking down in this direction, this is my so-called line of sight, my LOS. And the point is to get the total flux from a given direction, I have to add up all the contributions everywhere along the line of sight. So I might have a dark matter annihilation here, but in principle, I could have one here, or here, or here, and I want to sum those up, and that corresponds to this piece. This part here, sometimes the flux is defined without putting this in, but the idea here is that instead of just looking at a single infinitesimal direction, my detector has a finite resolution. So I do an average, even though my detector is pointed in a certain direction, I have a finite spread in my window, and I average over that. And this piece just tells me how likely it is for the dark matter to annihilate. So this is roughly the annihilation rate. And sometimes this piece is written in the following form. So this rewriting doesn't have any additional physical content, but it's popular in the literature. So this combination of things is sometimes called, so you can write this as your as a source term. So this is the particle physics source of cosmic rays. And we normalize it to the dark matter density at the location of the sun. So this dark matter density at the location of the sun is the usual 0.3 per cubic centimeter. This r sun is the distance to the sun. And this j, the j factor just contains all the line of sight junk with a slightly funny, oops. So the factors that have been taken out and put back in are just combined to make this quantity dimensionless. And that this is the actual dark matter density along the line of sight. And I normalize it to the local dark matter density. This is the distance from us to the sun. And that makes this DL dimensionless. And the solid angle part's already dimensionless. So this J is effectively a dimensionless quantity. And the factors that I put in here, I cancel out over here. So it's just a rewriting. But very often, you'll see for a given telescope that has some resolution, that's looking at a certain source of dark matter, let's say the galactic center, or something that we think is a clump of dark matter. When they do the observation, they'll quote their result in terms of the flux they see, and they'll also quote this J factor. So just in terms of terminology, this is a popular way to rewrite it, and it's useful to see. Okay, but in any case, if we know the dark matter distribution, and we know the distribution of energies from the annihilations, we can sit down and compute this flux and compare it to what the experiments see. Okay, so there are various ways to make photons from dark matter annihilation. So, well, I guess a very obvious way is I could have direct annihilation into photons, or possibly even photon Z. And it turns out that this annihilation mode is usually loop suppressed. In a lot of models, it's much less likely to happen than the other annihilation modes, let's say to W plus, W minus, or BV bar. But it's very distinctive. And the reason it's very distinctive is that the photons coming out of this process are monoenergetic. So in other words, the photon energy from this annihilation, instead of having a spread of energies, has a single specific energy. And it's not hard to tell that in the two-photon case, it's just the dark matter mass. And in the case of in the case of the gamma Z, it's this. So this is actually very useful, because most of the time I'm comparing some smooth astrophysical background to some less smooth dark matter signal. But in this case, the dark matter signal is really a spike. So if I was to plot the flux as a function of energy, my astro background is going to look something like this. And for this kind of signal, my dark matter signal would just be the photon signal would just be a single spike. And that's much easier to distinguish from background than something that's less spiky. So this is one nice way. But as I said, it also tends to happen less frequently than other annihilation modes. The way you get photons more frequently is in annihilations not to photons, but to other standard model particles. And in this case, you can get photons, for example, from, so suppose I have my dark matter annihilation through some unspecified mechanism. And suppose, for example, I go to electrons. Some fraction of the time, I have a chance to radiate a photon from one of the external legs because it's a charged particle. So this is Rumstrahlung. or sometimes it's also called FSR, for final state radiation. So you will always get a spectrum of photons from just about any sort of annihilation to charged particles. And also, along the way, some of these particles will decay down into stable stuff. And along the way, you can get pi zeros. And pi zeros, it turns out, decay to photon pairs primarily. So even if your dark matter doesn't tend to annihilate directly to photons, you'll get photons as products, as end products of these other annihilations. And these photons will have some energy spectrum. And the energy spectrum, well, depends on these details and so on. And people have looked into this. But what it turns out for this energy spectrum is it's not going to be a spike, obviously. It's going to be a spread out. Let me just find some colorful chalk. It's going to be spread out. But the thing is, the rate at which the spectrum of energies for these photons fall tends to be much slower than the way the background falls. So for this other kind of signal, I'm going to have I'm going to have something that looks more like that, where the spectrum cuts off fairly sharply at the dark matter mass. But the nice thing is it's still, people say the spectrum of these photons is harder than the background, in that the spectrum of these photons that come from other dark matter annihilation modes don't fall off in energy as fast as the background. And the third way that you can get photons is as a secondary. And this is especially useful for if you produce high energy leptons. So this process, or the dominant process, is usually called inverse Compton scattering. And suppose my dark matter annihilates to high energy electrons, or it could be muons or whatever else. But if I take the case of a high energy electron, the high energy electron can scatter off one of the photons floating around our galaxy. So these photons come from the CMB, or starlight, or dust. The most relevant ones here are usually the starlight photons. And you can have, let's say, your electron or positron annihilation product scatter off the photon. And this high energy electron is going to lose some energy. And that energy is going to be transferred to that energy is going to be transferred from this initial low energy photon to a high energy photon. And these effectively upkicked photons can also give you a visible signal. And they have their own very specific spectrum. So what you have to do to compare to experiment is add all of these contributions together and compare them to what you see. Now, one thing I want to point out here is if we think back to the signal from Pamela, this excess positron signal, to explain that we needed dark matter with two general properties. The first is the dark matter annihilation cross section had to be pretty big compared to what you need for thermal. So in other words, you needed some reasonably large boost factor. And the other thing you needed was that the dark matter should annihilate primarily into leptons. And one of the byproducts of that is that you're going to get additional photons from the leptonic annihilation, both from this Bremsstrahlung process as well as inverse Compton. And you can start, and that means that if dark matter is the reason for the Pamela signal, you start to also expect to see photon signals. And you can look at the cross correlation between how much of a signal you, how much annihilation you need to explain Pamela, and how much, how large of a photon signal you would expect. So this kind of photon signal is precisely what various telescopes have looked at. There's the sort of biggest game in town right now is called Fermi, the Fermi Space Telescope. But there are others. There's Hess. I won't list them all. But these photon telescopes, these gamma ray telescopes, focus on specific places in terms of dark matter searches that are especially promising. And the places to look are typically the galactic center, or GC, the galactic ridge, which is essentially the galactic plane plus a little bit of S, there's a diffuse, which means you point all over the place. And finally, you have so-called dwarf spheroidals. OK, so before I tell you about these things, let me also mention that when people talk about these signals, they very frequently use what are called galactic coordinates. And galactic coordinate means that you project the whole sky onto a big ellipse. And you choose your coordinates such that the our galaxy, the Milky Way, lies along this plane with the galactic center right in the middle. And this is Milky Way. But this is a map of the whole sky where you set the alignment towards the galactic center. And on this projection, you call this angle B and this angle L. So the galactic center is B, L small. The galactic ridge is essentially small b. The diffuse, there are various definitions, but it's usually pointing away from the galactic ridge. So you focus on these regions away from the Milky Way galaxy. And the dwarf spheroidal case is a little bit different. So these dwarf spheroidals are like little mini galaxies orbiting our own. So remember the cartoon of our galaxy is the galactic disk, and then we're some distance from the galactic center, and then this whole thing is surrounded by a dark matter halo. What dwarf spheroidals are little mini galaxies that are orbiting our own. And you can deduce the mass of these galaxies from their motion, these mini galaxies from the motion. And you can also deduce how much, how many stars they contain from the amount of light they give off. And what people find is that these dwarf spheroidals are very heavy compared to the amount of light they give off. And sometimes this is called a large mass to light. They're said to have a large mass to light ratio. And this is interpreted as these dwarf spheroidals as being little clumps of dark matter. So essentially little halos of dark matter with a few stars in them so we can see them, but mostly just clumps of dark matter floating around our galaxy.
So the angle B, do we measure it from the how is the angle measured?
Yeah, so this is 0 and it goes to 90, plus 90, minus 90.
I see. Okay.
Okay. So the upshot of all these searches is that these telescopes have looked in all these places. The galactic center is promising because we think that there's large dark matter density at the center of our galaxy. But of course, there's a lot of other stuff at the center of our galaxy. So the backgrounds are a problem. The galactic range is a bit similar. The diffuse signal tends to be, you don't have as much dark matter, so it's not promising. But these dwarf spheroidals happen to be really great. And these dwarf spheroidals are great. And we have maybe, I don't know, 10 to 12 that we know of around our galaxy. These things are, well, we think they're mostly dark matter. And they're going to have a dark matter profile within them. So for example, there's going to be some distribution of dark matter within a given dwarf spheroidal that, let's say, is close to the NFW profile or whatever else. So that means that you point your telescope at a dwarf spheroidal, you typically don't resolve them as anything more than a point source, but you have a lot of dark matter there in your field of view. So for reasonable estimates of how much dark matter you have in them, you can put limits on how well dark matter annihilates. And the result, so I'm just going to sketch the result, but the result also depends on the primary dark matter annihilation mode. But the result of primarily looking at dwarf spheroidals is that you can put limits on sigma v, and I'll use the centimeters cubed per second. In centimeters cubed per second, metric. Let me draw this a bit bigger. And so on. And this is a line that corresponds to 3 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second, the value that you expect for thermal. And depending on how the dark matter annihilates, you get bounds on the dark matter mass. You get exclusions that look like these lines. So let me also, this is about 10. 100, blah, blah, blah. So the point, the result of these searches based on dwarf spheroidals is that everything above this line is excluded. Now, having said that, the specific exclusions also depend on how your dark matter annihilates. So the line I've drawn corresponds roughly to your dark matter annihilating to W plus W minus. On the other hand, if your dark matter annihilates primarily to, I should have more colors here. If your dark matter annihilates mostly to mu plus mu minus, you get a weaker exclusion. So for mu plus mu minus, you get a weaker exclusion. And you can look at different dark matter annihilation modes and get various exclusions. But one thing that is interesting about this and exciting is that assuming you have a thermal dark matter candidate, and assuming it decays mostly or annihilates mostly to W plus W minus, then you get limits on the dark matter mass on the order of roughly 30 GeV. So these searches on dwarf spheroidals are starting to give very interesting limits on dark matter annihilation.
So I can't see what sex that is.
Oh, sorry. It's a dark matter mass. Yeah, sorry. I should get out of the habit. Let me just raise this up. I should get out of the habit of writing that low. Okay. So I want to move on to another kind of indirect detection signal. But before I do, let me just mention two other places where photons and dark matter annihilations can play a role. And those two other places are radio frequency photons. And the idea here, and this is especially true if you're injecting high energy leptons into the galaxy, is that you have a magnetic field. And when you inject high energy leptons, they're going to execute some kind of orbits, especially near the galactic center, and they're going to give off synchrotron. And the limits you get from this, from the amount of synchrotron radiation you see, are typically comparable to these limits. But they have larger systematic uncertainties. And they have a large systematic uncertainty because the amount of radiation you get depends on the magnetic fields near the galactic center, as well as the dark matter density near the galactic center. So these so-called radio frequency photons from synchrotron radiation from dark matter annihilation give you strong bounds on dark matter, but they're also very dependent on the astrophysics. So they're not quite as useful. A more robust effect is CMB. And the idea here is that your dark matter is going to keep on annihilating at some small level, even going backwards in time. And during the time that the reionization happened, when the photons decoupled from the electrons and the universe became transparent and produced the CMB radiation, these dark matter annihilations can inject additional photons into that spectrum. And this can change the power spectrum of the CMB. And based on what we have, doing a fit to it, you also get comparable limits from CMB photon injection to this kind of limit. And these limits are actually going to be improved a lot with new CMB data from the Planck satellite. So I wanted to mention this, but right now actually I want to move on to another kind of indirect detection signal, and that is the effect of dark matter annihilation in stars. So okay, so DM in stars. Okay, so the big idea behind this is that stars are made of nuclei, and we know from studying direct detection that dark matter can, in principle, scatter off nuclei. And one of the things that can happen in stars is dark matter floating along in a galaxy can be captured by a star. So it'll be gravitationally attracted to a star, but if a dark matter particle run into a star, the dark matter particle can start scattering with the nuclei in the star. And if the scattering is efficient, the dark matter can be captured. And what typically happens is that the dark matter floats to the middle of the star, and you build up some density. And if you start to build up enough of a density of dark matter in the middle of the star, the dark matter can annihilate. And when the dark matter annihilates, it can either heat up the star, or in the case of neutrinos might be able to get out. So there are two stories. For the star that we're most familiar with, the sun, the primary effect that we're interested in is neutrinos coming out of the sun, and neutrinos coming out of the sun from dark matter annihilation. Whereas for other stars that are farther away, and these are typically more extreme stars like neutron stars or white dwarfs, the heating effect tends to be more important in terms of observational tests. So let me.
So the solar neutrino that was discovered a few years ago, is that?
Oh, you know, people have been seeing neutrinos from the sun for over 50 years.
Oh, I see.
But those neutrinos that we see from the sun are produced by nuclear reactions.
Right.
With
right.
Typical energy is kind of in the MeV range.
Right.
Whereas these would be much more energetic neutrinos.
I see.
And there's actually a very specific way to see them by looking for upward-going muons in a neutrino detector. So I'll get to that. Okay. But the way we describe this process, or this process can be described in a very simple way, and that is you look at the time evolution of the total number, n is the total number of dark matter particles in a star. And this piece, the first bit is that this piece is proportional to something that's independent of n from capture. So you have a capture coefficient. You have a piece that goes like n squared from an annihilation. And you have a piece that's linear in n from so-called evaporation. So let me describe these pieces in turn. So C is the total capture rate. Of dark matter on the star. And this capture rate depends typically on how efficiently dark matter your dark matter particle scatters with nuclei. So what you need to capture on the star is, first of all, your dark matter particle has to hit the star one way or another. But once it does, your dark matter particle also has to scatter with stuff in the star in such a way that your dark matter velocity is lowered below the escape velocity from the star. So dark matter must scatter to be less than the escape velocity from the star. And like, depending on your star, the escape velocity will be larger or smaller. And depending on the density of the star, you'll be more or less likely to scatter. In the case of the sun, the escape velocity from the sun is about 600 kilometers per second on the surface of the sun, all the way up to about 1,400 kilometers per second in the middle of the sun. So this escape velocity is actually pretty big compared to the typical dark matter velocity coming in, which is on the order of 300 kilometers per second. So dark matter should capture reasonably well in terms of the kinematics on the sun. But the other thing you have to worry about is the cross-section. And in the case of the sun, the complete expression is complicated. And the complete expression on the sun or other stars also depends on what nuclei the star contains. In the case of the sun, you have roughly 75% hydrogen, 25% helium, and some smaller amounts of heavier elements. In many cases, the hydrogen and helium scattering dominates. And sort of a useful rule of thumb is that your capture rate on the sun, at least, is sort of order 10 to the 23 dark matter particles per second for these sort of fiducial parameters. So in the case that spin-dependent scattering of hydrogen dominates, this is the parametric dependence of the capture rate on the sun. And you can have very different capture rates on other stars. In principle, you can also capture in the Earth. But the sun usually gives you the best limits. So parametrically, you get order 10 to the 23 per second. So the next piece I'll go to is the annihilation part. And to understand the annihilation part, you actually have to look at what the dark matter does after it's been captured. And what typically happens after the dark, after a dark matter particle has been captured in the sun, so suppose my dark matter comes in and is captured here. After it's captured and it undergoes a scattering that keeps it inside the sun, that scatters it to below the escape velocity, after that, your dark matter goes much slower and it's going to go around and bounce off and scatter off the stuff in the sun more and more. And eventually, your dark matter thermalizes with the sun. With the interior of the star. And by thermalize, I just mean that the dark matter acquires the same temperature as the stuff in the star. And what you end up getting with this is the dark matter, once it thermalizes, condenses into a so-called thermal sphere. So a sphere where the pressure of the sphere is held up by the thermal energy, and is counteracted by the gravitational attraction of the center of the star, and you end up in a central sphere, a central thermal sphere in the middle of the star. So this thermal sphere corresponds to a balance between the gravitational interaction of the mass of the star to the dark matter compared to the thermal pressure of the dark matter. And this thermal sphere radius is roughly 3t over 2 pi m pi g rho, where rho is the density of the star. And in the case of the sun, the thermosphere radius is about 1% of the radius of the sun. Let me just write this down. For a dark matter mass of 100 GeV. So in the case of the sun, once dark matter captures, assuming it's a mass of about 100 GeV, it'll collect near the center of the sun. And at the center of the sun, it'll form a, sort of a ball of dark matter that is much smaller than the total radius of the sun. OK, so the actual annihilation part is going to correspond to essentially the square of the dark matter density in this thermal sphere times the physical particle annihilation cross section. So this A coefficient turns out to be just the thermally averaged annihilation cross section in the middle of the sun divided by the volume of the thermal sphere. So I've written this for the sun, but in general, it goes for any star that you capture.
Compute the thermal average. What goes into that thermal average for the sun? What's the kind of the significance of the sun symbol? Do we use the temperature, which is the temperature of the sun?
Yeah. The same formula applies to any star, but in this thermal average, you use the effective temperature in the middle of the sun. So you use essentially the core temperature of the sun, which I think is sort of on the order of a keV. So the distribution functions you use for this are a fair bit different from the distribution functions you would use for dark matter annihilation in the early universe. And actually, what important feature of this, and actually this also applies to other indirect detection signals, is that the V, the V in the galaxy is sort of order 10 to the minus 3. And in the sun, it can be even smaller. And so I'll say V less. So for these indirect detection signals, your dark matter velocity tends to be very small. Whereas for freeze-out, it turns out that a typical velocity during freeze-out is more like 10 to the minus 1. So one important implication of this is, suppose your dominant dark matter annihilation channel is goes like b squared. So remember, we wrote that in the non-relativistic limit, r sigma v goes like a sigma naught plus sigma 1 b squared, dot, dot, dot. If this is the dominant piece for freeze out, then you'll get the same contribution for indirect detection. On the other hand, if your dominant freeze out piece is this, and let's say this is zero or very suppressed, then that means that your indirect detected signals will be very suppressed. So it's good to keep this in mind, just in this so-called, this piece is sometimes called a S wave, and this piece is called a P wave. And if your dark matter annihilation is dominantly P wave, you tend to not to get very good indirect detection signal. And the reason for that is precisely that the thermal average you do here involves the distribution functions corresponding to the temperature at the core of the sun. Okay, so this is annihilation. I'm running out of room, but okay, I'll just go back here and erase this. And the third term, is evaporation. And the idea of evaporation is that, remember, your distribution function for stuff in the sun goes like it's basically just some Boltzmann. But the Boltzmann distribution has a tail going out to very high energies. And every so often, you'll have a scattering between some particle, some nucleus in the sun, and a dark matter particle, where that nucleus has an unexpectedly large or an especially large energy. And that can transfer an especially large energy to the dark matter particle. And in that case, the dark matter particle can be ejected out of the sun. So in the case of evaporation, this corresponds to the ejection with especially high energy nuclei. And it turns out that to actually estimate it is a little bit delicate. But at least in the case of the sun, this process is typically not relevant unless the dark matter particle is pretty light. Is lighter than about 3 GeV. So for the time being, I'm going to ignore evaporation. But if you happen to have an especially light dark matter candidate, it's something you should worry about.
So the coefficient E is not the E in the distribution.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So this is So the E tilde is the energy. The E coefficient is the E coefficient I wrote here. Yeah. Maybe I'll write it as a sort of an epsilon.
I mean, we're ignoring it in this case.
We're ignoring it, so it's going to disappear. But just to avoid any possible confusion. Okay, but the upshot of this is that I now have a competition between capture and annihilation. And I'm typically going to start with not too many dark matter particles inside my star, but I'm going to, as a star ages, it's going to capture more and more dark matter. And initially, we expect this term to win out. But if we wait long enough, this piece is going to start populating. This piece will start populating, and once I get to large end, this piece will kick in. And what typically happens for n as a function of time is I start off by rising linearly until this piece kicks in and I reach a steady state. And once I reach a steady state, n dot is 0. these two pieces cancel, I'm ignoring evaporation. And once I reach a steady state, this steady state, this steady state will give me the rate of stuff being ejected from the sun. I'm going to write over here. Okay, so in the steady state, it's trivial to solve. N is just C over A square root. And the steady state's great, but there's also a corresponding equilibration time, and the equilibration time. The equilibration time is also straightforward to work out, and the time it takes to reach equilibrium is roughly 1 over root CA. And it turns out that this equilibration time is much, much less than the age of the sun, which is about 4.5 billion years. Provided your dark matter annihilation cross section provided your dark matter annihilation cross section and capture rate are not too tiny. So the numerical condition is that your annihilation rate in the case of the sun should be larger than about 3 times 10 to the minus 30 centimeters cubed per second. So this is 4 orders of magnitude smaller than thermal. Times GeV over m chi, the 1/2, and 10 to the minus 40 centimeters squared over sigma p, assuming a spin-dependent capture on mostly on hydrogen. So in many cases, you're very likely to reach a steady state in the sun. And once you reach a steady state, you can look at what that steady state looks like and ways to test it. So first of all, it turns out that typically, if you reach a steady state, the density of dark matter in the core of the sun is very, very small compared to the density of nuclei in the core of the sun. So dark matter doesn't change the gravitational properties in the center of the sun. It doesn't really change the evolution of the sun very much. But what you do get is the dark matter annihilation starts injecting some energy in the sun, which turns out to be very small compared to the energy released by nuclear reactions. But the thing you do get that is different from nuclear reactions is high energy annihilation products. So what you get in the core of the sun is your dark matter annihilates chi-chi into some standard model stuff. And the standard model stuff, for everything except neutrinos, will just be captured in the core of the sun and just heated up. But in the case of a neutrino, the neutrinos can get out of the sun. And these neutrinos can get out of the sun, and they can travel all the way to the Earth and hit us over here. And we can look for them in neutrino detectors. Now, the interesting thing interesting thing is the scale for these neutrinos will be sort of the dark matter mass. Should have brought water. The scale of the neutrinos will be the dark matter mass instead of the MeV neutrino energy you expect from nuclear reactions. And that makes these neutrinos very distinguishable from a lot of other backgrounds. So you get backgrounds, first of all, from the sun, but those have too low energy. You also get backgrounds from cosmic rays, so cosmic ray muons. But the nice thing about neutrinos is that they go through everything. So what you have to look for is a so-called upward-going neutrino flux. Sorry, I should say upward muon flux. And the idea here is that if I blow up this picture, suppose I have a neutrino detector that's below the surface of the Earth. And here's the Earth in not a very good diagram. The neutrino comes in, and the neutrino passes through the whole Earth. And if I'm lucky, the neutrino, when it gets close to my detector, will hit something, like some dirt or a rock or something, and scatter into a muon. So what I look for is a muon with very high energy going up in my detector. And there are experiments that are looking for this. There's IceCube and Antares. And the upshot of these searches is that the strength of the signal, remember, coincides with how well you capture, how efficiently you capture in the sun. So you can translate the fluxes of upward-going muons, or the lack of them, into limits on the direct detection cross-section. So in the case of if the dark matter scattering is mostly spin-independent, the direct detection searches are stronger than these indirect searches. But if you have a dark matter candidate that annihilates efficiently in the sun and scatters in direct detection experiments mostly through spin-dependent scatterings, you actually get very strong bounds from this. So the region you rule out from direct detection searches looks like that. The region you end up ruling out from where this is like sort of 10 GeV, let me just move this up. So this is the dark matter mass in GeV. This is kind of a 100. So these spin-dependent cross-sections rule out that region, but you get an exclusion for larger. You get an exclusion for larger cross-sections and larger dark matter masses for from this upward-going muon flux. So the specific limits depend on how your dark matter annihilates. So two canonical examples are W plus W minus. And W plus W minus is nice because the W can decay directly to a neutrino, and that neutrino is going to be very high energy. On the other hand, if your dark matter annihilates, let's say, a BB bar, your neutrinos are going to be much softer because they come from the endpoint of a B decay. So I get weaker limits from dark matter annihilate to BB bar. But at least at the moment, it looks like these, at least for larger dark matter masses, you get stronger bounds from this indirect search under certain assumptions than you do from the direct detection search. Okay, so I'm just about out of time. Let me just say in a couple minutes, one other interesting effect this kind of capture can have. There's a similar story to solar capture, which is you can also capture inside the Earth in the same way, but you don't capture as efficiently, and typically those bounds are much weaker. Typically the Earth bounds are much weaker than the solar bounds. The other cases that can be interesting are neutron stars. or a white dwarf. So neutron star NS, white dwarf WD. So a neutron star is a star that is supported against gravitational collapse, not by a thermal pressure, but by a Fermi degeneracy pressure of neutrons. So the neutron degeneracy pressure supports a neutron star. A white dwarf is a slightly lighter object that's supported by the electron degeneracy pressure. And in both of these cases, because the support is coming from, because the thing that's supporting you against collapse is not a thermal energy, if you just leave a neutron star and you let it sit around, or a white dwarf and you let it sit around, it's just going to keep on cooling and cooling and cooling. So what I would expect for this kind of star is, as a function of time, if I look at the temperature of the star, in both cases, normally on its own, it should just keep on falling and falling and falling. On the other hand, if I have dark matter that's being captured on these stars and is sinking to the middle and is annihilating, that dark matter is going to inject energy into the core of the star. And that's going to heat the star. So the story is that if I have no dark matter and I let my neutron star sit long enough, it's going to get just colder and colder and colder. Whereas with dark matter, I'm going to have the same fall off in temperature until the dark matter annihilation kicks in. So this gives you a test of dark matter. It's a negative test in that if you see a neutron star with a certain temperature, that doesn't mean that the neutron star has dark matter in it. But on the other hand, if you see a neutron star that has a temperature lower than a certain amount, and you know what the local dark matter density is, where the neutron star is, you can actually rule out dark matter with those properties. So these bounds give you strong limits on, yes?
Is there a way to figure out how old a neutron star is, and therefore what the temperature should be, and then compare that against dark matter?
Yeah, I don't remember the story off the top of my head. I think you can to some extent, but even without being able to peg down the precise age of the star, you are able to put a lower bound on a neutron star temperature if you know the local density of dark matter where that neutron star is. So even without measuring even without knowing the age of the star, as soon as you measure a temperature lower than some amount, it depends on the local dark matter density, you can rule out that dark matter. So this can give you a very strong test of dark matter. But you do have the astrophysical uncertainty that you need to know the local dark matter density. So I'll wrap it up there. I guess in the next two lectures, I want to talk about looking for dark matter colliders, and also an alternative to the WIMP picture, which is something called axions. And axions are particles related to, there's a puzzle related to QCD, and axions help solve this puzzle. And it turns out they're also good dark matter candidates. So I'll tell you about that.